Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.
Pixel Sift is proudly supported by Murdoch University School of Arts. Do you want to learn to make your own Twitch channel or podcast and outclass the competition? Well, the skills you learn in a creative degree in games, sound, film, or journalism will put you in a class of your own. Have a look at murdoch.edu.au/arts to learn more about what they've got on offer. That's murdoch.edu.au/arts, or you can search Murdoch University for more information. Murdoch University School of Arts, proudly supporting Pixel Sift.
Pixel Sift.
Yes, yes, hello and welcome to Pixel Sift, the show dedicated to indie games from around Australia and the world. My name is Scott, and joining me tonight is my co-host Gianni. How are we, sir?
I am fantastic, sir. How are you?
Very well. Tonight, our guest is Thomas Jansen. He's here to tell us all about his new game, Death Hall. Thanks for joining us, Thomas.
Thank you for having me. It's awesome to be here.
Absolute pleasure. Excited. But first off, Gianni, what else are we taking a look at today?
Yeah, we're going to be looking at the wish listing. I have a lot of wish lists, but in particular, we're talking about Steam wish listing and what impact that has on developers and what impact that has on players as well.
Fantastic. Let's jump into it.
Let's do it.
You're listening to Pixel Sift, or you might be watching Pixel Sift on Twitch. Pixel Sift.
Scott, do you have Steam wish list?
Look, I don't really use it. I actually completely forgot that I'd used it at all until very recently. I have only wish list one game, and that was Player Unknown Battleground. And I did pick it up when it was on sale, but I forgot about it because I stopped playing it pretty quickly because I was a bit unimpressed.
All right. Well, you know, you're not the poster boy for wish lists, obviously.
No, I'm not.
Well, the reason why we're talking about wish lists today, because there is a bit of a tricky relationship, according to Ross Manthorpe, who is from GameMaker. He says that the wish list is actually quite often used as a discoverability tool, and that's the reason why developers always ask you. They say, hey, if you like the game, it's on Steam, give it a wish list. And he said that that is part of the reason why that it is kind of encouraged, and it's why a lot of people do have a lot of things on their wish list. A lot of people do use wish lists as their way to find deals or to find sales as well. So it's something that's helpful for the players, but it's also really helpful for developers. Tom, I'm curious, do you have a wish list on Steam or a digital platform that you use? What do you think of them?
Absolutely. I use Steam all the time, and I think I have about 40 to 50 games on my wish list, just there ready to go. I kind of use it as a way to remember what games I want, and if anything goes on sale and I feel particularly generous, I'll just buy it because I know that I want that game. So it's an awesome tool for me personally. Yeah.
Do you feel like you're moving it from your wish list and then moving it into your library and then never play the game at all?
Possibly sometimes. I have a backlog of about 3 games. So I'm not a
3. That's pretty backlog. Good.
Yeah, I'm pretty when I buy a game, I usually wait a very long time until you know, reviews come out, user reviews come out. I can learn a bit more about the game. I'm not sort of a first day release kind of gamer. I'll wait for a while. So if I buy something, I really know that I want to play it, and I'll go ahead and just beat it within a week, generally, just play it to death. So
I can 100% relate with that, actually. You know, I'll only wish list a game that I don't want to, that I already haven't decided that I really want to play, like right now. I'll kind of wish list it because maybe I can't afford it right now, or, you know, I just want to kind of save it that I might buy it later, but I'm not very good at wish lists because I ignore the notifications.
Yeah. And if you've bought like a few games already that month and you don't want to buy anything else because, you know, that's going to blow the budget,
exactly.
Or because gaming is an expensive hobby.
Sure.
Wish listing for me is a great way to, remember what I want. It's all there, easily accessible. I use it a lot.
It's really interesting. In this article by Ross Manthorpe, you can read it on gameindustry.biz, and you'll be able to find a link to it in the show notes of this podcast as well. He speaks to a number of different developers, and one of them is David Galindo of Vertigo Gaming, who are the developers of Cook Serve Delicious series. And David says, the moment you release info about your next game, you should 100% absolutely have a Steam page ready to go. There's no excuse not to, and it's just plain bad strategy to miss out on those potential wish list. Tom, you're a developer and you're making a game at the moment which has come out for iOS. Is there an equivalent for this on the app stores as well?
I think definitely on every platform there will be differences in the lead up and the strategy for marketing and getting the word of the game's release out there. But the importance of it, of doing that and going through that process months before the game's release, you know, there's always a long lead up to a game release, no matter how big or small it is. The importance of that is the same for every platform. So releasing a mobile game, your target audience might be different. The websites and forums that you go to drum up support and interest in the game might be different. But that process is still super important for sure. And I think the App Store, it must have been a couple of years ago, the App Store, I'm not sure about Google Play, because I haven't developed for Android before, but I know that for sure on the Apple App Store a while ago, they started their pre-order system. So it's effectively wish listing, except, you know, the users will basically submit that they want to buy the game as soon as it comes out. So it's similar, but different.
It's interesting, the pre-ordering on iPhone and app stores like that, because usually you pre-order something because you think it's going to run out, which it absolutely can't do in a digital storefront. There's 100 infinite copies, you know. Yeah. There's no way that you could ever do that. But it's interesting that you kind of get that first little push of information. And I actually have pre-ordered a few games that have come out. I remember Paperbark and Florence were two games that I actually pre-ordered on the store because I wanted to get it as soon as it came out. So, and I knew I was going to buy it. So I was like, there we go.
Yeah.
Give them a couple of bucks now. Why not?
Yeah. And if it only costs a few bucks, it's a lot easier to pre-order something like that than it is than a $15, $20, $30 game on Steam. It's a lot easier to click the pre-order button for sure.
Part of that same article from Ross Manthorpe, there's a quote from Seth Koster of Butterscotch Shenanigans, who kind of espouses the same as David, saying discoverability is the number one driver of adding a game to a wish list. Without that, nothing else matters. Because, you know, if people can't find the game, or if people aren't reminded about the game, which is what I love about the notification idea. I love the idea of the wish list. Like I said, I'm not good at it.
Seth, in that article, actually goes to expand on that a little bit more, saying that like there's a slightly larger fraction of people who'll be interested in the game, but perhaps they're too busy and they don't want to spend any money right now, or they're currently in some other game, so they don't buy it, they just wishlist it. And that second group of people is inherently larger than the first group. So anytime your game gains that visibility through sale, through featuring or through some influencer, sales pop up and your wishlists pop up even more. But the key driver of all of this is visibility. Now, we have been asking people on Twitter and on Twitch and on Discord about why people what they wishlist and what was the last games that they put on their wishlist that they purchased. Lucas Gintuki on Discord says, I love wishlisting game. The last time I bought a game from my wishlist was today. I pre-ordered Shadowkeep, and I wishlist games as more of a way to remind me of what games I'm interested in rather than anyone buying me a game. Wish on Discord says, I've never really had a wish list, but the closest game that was on my wish list was Overwatch. I saw the cinematic for Overwatch and I thought it was a movie. Then I realized it was a game, instantly wanted it, found it out it was set to release in like 2 weeks, and then I bought it. So there you go. There was also a bit of controversy recently because there was one of these, like the sale function of a wish list is a huge factor for a lot of people. People wait so that they can pick up a Steam sale, and they have these things on their wish list, knowing that they do like the game, they want to play it when it comes out, but maybe they can't afford to buy it at the full price, or maybe they're playing something else at the moment. But the one of the recent summer sales that just came out, there was a part of the promotion, and maybe the wording of the promotion was slightly incorrect. It basically had a deal where you could get free games from your Steam wish list. So what it was supposed to do was you were supposed to reshuffle your wish list to say, I want the top three games, the top five games, top 10 games, or whatever it was. You put them at the top of your list. But what had actually happened was people thought that what you had to do was effectively clear out your wish list. And so a lot of indie games got deleted off their wish lists because they inherently weren't a huge value game. Most of them were pretty cheap. So people were putting really high AAA expensive titles on there to kind of maximize their chances of winning something really good on the Steam sale. And there were lots of people who got really badly hurt by that, including the developer of Wildfire, who put on a big thing saying that was a massive drop in the number of people wishlisting the game. It just dropped to nothing. And it wasn't until like there was a social media campaign to kind of come back from that, that they were able to sort of build those numbers back up again. But yeah, for people who didn't sort of realize that the wish lists had been hammered by this penalty, it was like a real challenging sort of situation.
Thanks for watching Pixel Sift, your indie game interview podcast live on Twitch. If you've just tuned in, we're talking about Steam wish lists and their relationship to actual sales. That was a really interesting point you made there, Gianni, about the summer sales. The effect that something like that, a poorly worded marketing campaign by Steam, can really damage the bottom line and the future prospects of indie developers, who arguably that kind of thing matters the most to them, really, because they're not big companies.
Yeah, it was really tricky because this is the thing. If they don't have a huge marketing budget.
No.
Daniel Hines was the person who actually noticed this particular function, one of the developers of Wildfire. But yeah, like that's it. If you're an indie team and you're one person or two people, you need to do everything you can to try and maximize the amount of eyes that you can get in front of your game.
Yeah,
if
people start purging you from their wish lists en masse because, of a badly worded campaign, it's pretty frustrating. And Steam did fix it, they made an attempt to fix it by sending out, tweets and making up new pictures and whatever, but they didn't update everything that they'd already done. So they could have done better there, I think.
Yeah, in an article that was on gameindustry.biz, Kitsune Games founder Emma Masson shared her wish list actions graph, which is basically it's sort of like statistics. You can see how your game is performing on Steam. It goes, anyway, in the case that people are confused, Valve's stupid little mini game can get people off their wish list for free. But because people think it's random, they're delisting small indie games from their wish lists en masse.
That does make
sense.
Wish
lists are vital to performance on Steam.
Yeah, absolutely.
We asked a few more people online to see what they thought about it. Aaron on Facebook, on the Pixel Sift Facebook, says Steam has had the fractured but whole 90% off. So I snapped it up. It was on my wish list for a few months now. But the great thing about it is that you can see it. But if you're you see a game you want, but you aren't in a rush to play it, you wish list it and you can wait for the sale alert to come through. Alex on the Pixel Sift Facebook says, I don't wish list games because I mostly play on console. I'd love for Sony to add the functionality to let me know which games I have wishlisted are on sale. Tom, what do you think? What would be the best way for wishlists to be improved in your, either from a developer's perspective or from someone who plays games?
Not badly worded campaigns like that. I think I remember reading about that. That's for an indie developer, that would just be devastating to find that out. Like the storefront that you've put your game up, it's such an important part of release and pre-release. And for that storefront to then do something like that, it could have been handled a lot better. But to improve wish lists, that's a tricky question because I think as a gamer, for me, it is such a great tool to not discover games, but to have a list there that I know that maybe one day I will purchase. And I know I've probably purchased maybe 15 to 20 games over the past few years that I've had on my wish list. So I'm not sure how you could improve it unless there was some sort of, there's already an emailing system. Steam can already send you automatic notifications through your email. If a game goes on sale, that's another really good tool. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's probably the limit of my marketing expertise, sending an email when something goes on sale.
Yeah.
We
might go for a few more comments from people. So the Game Heart on Instagram says, there was just a Devolver digital sale and I grabbed up a couple of things off my wish list, including my friend Pedro and Gris. Awesome. And Castle Black Studio on Instagram says, I've been wanting to get Mario Party for the Switch for our studio for such a long time. We got it last month and it's the best game for office parties. Scott, what do you know, anything other than PUBG, have you ever got anything else off your wish list?
Not really. And I have a pretty good reason for it. It's because I humble bundle monthly and get all sorts of stuff through there. So I think that's kind of ruined my interaction with the Steam storefront a bit. I kind of just put it on like autopilot and figure I'll get a bunch of good games and I'll check them out and eventually I'll get the games that I'm looking for, which, to be honest, has been true up until now.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think there's obviously, there's only one way to do it, but there's plenty of way to play games and you can be playing them on mobile, you can be playing them on Steam, you can get them on Humble or wherever you want. It's interesting. And I think the one thing to sort of take away from it is that if you do like a game and you like the small developer who is making an interesting game and there is an opportunity to give them a wish list on Steam, do it for them because it makes really a big difference.
So there's one thing to take away from that. Yeah, it's that.
It's a good way you can help them out. So, all right, shall we jump into our next topic?
Yes, we should definitely shall.
Visit us on pixelsift.com.au.
Yes, tonight we're talking to Thomas Jansen about his latest game, Death Hall. It's been described as an action platformer with an awesome upgrade system. So, Thomas, if that doesn't paint enough of a picture for our viewers, in your words, what's Death Hall all about?
Death Hall is a high skill ceiling, challenging platforming game on iOS right now. And it challenges the player to traverse a series of trap-laden, enemy-laden stages of the underground lair of a giant blob monster as it chases you nonstop. So it's very fast-paced. You only have a limited number of lives, and everything is trying to kill you. It's basically the game in a nutshell. And it also culminates in a large boss battle where the blob monster will reach its final form, which would be spoilers.
Yeah.
to explain. It was a three-year project in all to work on in my spare time. And it was a very fun project. I'm super excited to be showing it at PAX Australia this year.
Yeah, well, selected for the Indie Showcase, that must be a huge thing for you. How does that feel?
It's a huge honor.
But not the first time you've been selected either.
No. It's kind of a funny story. I submitted Death Hall earlier this year, not thinking anything would happen, that they would notice, hey, that's the same name that we saw a few years ago. But in 2014, it was the second PAX in Australia, and I submitted another iOS game that I'd made at the time called Wave, which is another super challenging game in the vein of Super Hexagon. And that got selected for the showcase as well, the Indie Showcase. And I was privileged enough to show it there too. So I am familiar with the process, which means I'm freaking out about the show just as much as I was then. But so excited to be showing people the game, because showing a game that you've spent so much time crafting and building at a show that is so positive and is so heavily focused on gamers and developers coming together and talking about the games that developers have made, you get a really positive reception from everyone that plays the game. There's not really a lot of criticism or negativity there. So
it's a good space to be in.
Really exciting. Yeah.
Hey, you mostly made this game by yourself. Is that right?
Yes, except for the music. So, I work with an amazing musician, but all the animation, the visuals, programming, that was me.
So what is it like showing off your game like that by yourself? Because it's hard enough for people who are in big teams to do that. How do you manage that at a show like PAX?
Good question. I'm still trying to figure it out. We'll see. In 2014, I had a friend who was also a big gamer. And he had played the game. He knew what it was all about. He'd been to PAX before. And we actually both worked in retail together. So we were good at talking to people, and retail was where we first met. So it was very natural for him to come and help me out for the full 3 days. And I was super lucky to have an extra person there. My musician, Gareth, is he is based in Melbourne, so it's convenient for him to come to the show and help me out this year. He's offered to help, which is great, but you know, I don't want to pressure him into being there all the time. He can go around and look at different things and play games and things, but yeah, I'll definitely have 10 water bottles off to the side, muesli bars, you know, maybe a bucket for, you know, maybe not. it should be okay. It should be okay if I can duck away to grab something to eat. Or
I think it'd be very fun.
Yeah, should be okay.
Check out. It's an intense weekend.
But I think
it is. Yeah.
So, Thomas, working by yourself and, you know, not having a team to kind of bounce ideas off and to get things running with, where does the inspiration for a game like this come from?
Making games as a solo developer is a huge problem for me. I'm more of a highly focused on details kind of artist. Game design is a mix of details and broad scope. So the way my brain works, it's very focused on details and creative details. So I actually find game design quite hard to do on my own. Getting feedback and starting that feedback loop very early in a game's development has always been a huge issue. I would usually make games and construct and prototype the base game with core gameplay very quickly. But then that would be dev difficulty. With every game I've ever made, I've started with dev difficulty, which means I can pass the first level, but nobody else can in the world. I'm the only person that can beat the first because everything's just way too hard. And I haven't thought about what makes the game fun for players. And it's taken a long time to kind of learn what design means. And design means to adapt and learn to what people want, to what the experience is that they want. So the feedback loop is probably the most important, I think, as an indie dev that's programming and, you know, doing all of the art on their own, or even if it's two people, the feedback loop is super important. Getting friends and getting family sometimes isn't enough to get feedback from them, because you know what they'll say. They'll say, oh, it's great. Just keep going. You're doing a great job.
Just keep at it, mate.
Yeah, always. It never changes.
And so you need to find enemies to give you feedback.
Yeah. it's always, you know, 10 out of 10. And sometimes we need critical feedback,
yeah.
But people aren't usually willing to give that. So you kind of have to solicit it. So the feedback loop is probably the number one thing for me personally as a developer.
It's funny you mentioned that with the difficulty as well. When I was doing a little bit of a research for the game, I came across a few forums that were discussing the game and also about spruiking the game. I think you even jumped in on a couple of the threads. But basically, the general consensus was this game is actually really freaking hard, but totally worth it and full of spoilers. So couldn't actually find a lot of information about it.
Yeah. Was that with Death Hole, or was that with another game that you found on forum?
That one was with Death Hole, but I did come across the Wave stuff as well.
Yeah. Even with other games that I haven't made available for sale anymore because either they broke with new versions of iPhones and versions of iOS and things. With those games as well, I made a game where you were a little character walking along a set of 2D platforms with a baseball bat, hitting baseballs as they come at you, and you've got to hit monsters that are zombies that are falling out of the sky, and they have parachutes and they swing, and there's also another monster chasing you. It's just too much. There was another game before that where it was a simple game where you would leap and try to leap as far as possible, but the control scheme, you needed to touch the screen with like three different fingers at the same time. It's just way too much. And I'd always get the same feedback from family. It's great, keep going. But when you release the game, you then realize it is too difficult. I haven't thought enough about the player experience. Frankly, it's taken me a long time to learn that part of game design, to make it more accessible, really. That's the key word.
Well, I'm very glad you kept at it.
Yeah.
Because practice makes perfect.
Getting there.
And it's looking awesome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for watching Pixel Sift. If you're watching one of our live platforms, we're talking to Thomas Jansen about his game Death Hole, selected for the PAX Australia Indie Showcase for 2019.
What?
It sounds like it's been a bit of a journey of like a self understanding as you're making this game. Is this game finished?
Death Hole is 99% finished.
Ooh. Okay.
100%. I don't think it will ever get there, but
yep.
I had a plan in place where if the game met a certain number of sales, and it may or may not happen in the future, I would commit to doing certain updates, but it's as finished as it can be.
And I guess, you know, what's the thing that you've kind of really learnt about the way that you do game development? What would you do differently for your next title as you're working on something something new?
I would start with it's such a good question. There's so many different ways to answer it, but I think one thing I would do is to get feedback as soon as I have something playable, like immediately. Because as soon as I have something playable, that is the core experience. You set the scene, you set the characters, you set the platforms, whatever the gameplay is. You pretty much just have one action that the player can do and a game over screen. That's it. And then get feedback. And then from then you can gauge so many things. You can gauge what people think of the controls, what people think of is it funny? Is it memorable? Will they talk about it again after they've played it when they go away? Will they mention it to their friends? That's what I would do. That's what I would change. Rather than spending 6 months working on something, toiling away, but it might not be right and it's too late to adjust. So that's the big, big thing that I would do.
Do you think you'd want to work by yourself again to make this game, or will you be looking to make a team so that you can actually bounce things off other people internally as it's being made?
Yep, definitely. 100%. I don't want to work out of my bedroom or at home in any way, shape or form ever again. That'd be nice. Because, I mean, I've been doing that for 10 years, just working on side projects. And it is okay, but, you know, variety is the spice of life. And working with people and changing the environment that I work in, being able to bounce off other people is something I've not been able to experience, or have not put myself in that situation. I would love to work with other people on a new project in the future.
One thing that really kind of captured me, or when I was playing the game, is it really has that feel of a lot of those sort of early Flash games, especially the difficulty of it as well. Was that an inspiration for you as you were designing the visuals and sort of the gameplay?
It was. I used to love playing Flash games in high school. I'd run up to the library at lunchtime and play all those sorts of games.
Newgrounds. Lining up Newgrounds at school.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. That was like a rite of passage, I think.
Yeah, it really was. Friendships were forged on Newgrounds, pretty much. So it was. When I started working on Deathloop, I wanted to make a simple game, but the difficulty not being simple, but the game itself being simple. And I wanted it to be a six-month project so I could finish it quickly, but... You know, I then started work in Sydney as an animator full time, and that blew the scope of the project out, or blew the time that it would take to finish the project out by quite a lot. Ended up being about 3 years, which is okay.
That's fine. You can't rush these things, you know.
Yeah, you can't rush it. And I'm so upset, sprite perfect that I just can't help myself. I remember thinking I wanted it to be simple, but it didn't end up being that.
What about the style of the art as well? Can you tell us a bit, like, what was some of the visual inspiration behind the visuals of the game?
Yeah, that started out being pixel art, actually. I started experimenting with pixel art because it's such a cool aesthetic, and you can get really impactful animations and effects reasonably quickly, depending on the detail. But then I wanted to try something different, so I transitioned into kind of a lo-fi character designs, which then started to become more high definition because I had so many frames of animation. So it ended up just being a kind of a weird mishmash of different styles until I kind of finalized the visuals that you see in Death Hall today, which was just me madly trying to finish as many sprites of animation as possible in limited time. So I don't think the visuals honestly were inspired by anything. It just kind of ended up being a mishmash of my weird drawing style.
Well, it's a very entertaining drawing style, I must say. I enjoy it immensely. Yeah. And obviously, like
that's great.
You've spent a lot of time not only developing this game, I'm sure you've spent a lot of time playing it also. What is your favorite aspect of the game?
My favorite aspect of the game is that the game encourages the player to run nonstop. And if you do so and you take limited damage and you never stop running, the game notices this, and if you then die or you reach the end and it's game over, that skill level of the player playing the game is calculated into the final score. So if you never take damage and you never stop running, even for a tenth of a second, then your score can multiply up to 3 times.
Sweet.
So it's a way of encouraging you. Yeah, it's a way of encouraging you to never stop and to be very skillful. Yeah. So it doesn't do anything other than that. There's no, like, you don't buy lots of different items. There are a couple of items, but it's not a huge aspect of the game. The big aspect of the game, once the player kind of understands what the game's all about and they have to try to get to the end, they notice that there's a haste multiplier on the game end screen, and then they learn the mechanic of never slowing down, taking little damage and playing skillfully. And I like that. That the discovery that the game is encouraging you to just go nuts and just run forever nonstop to kind of get into the flow. There's that the flow state that some game designers talk about.
Absolutely,
basically
creativity in general.
That.
So it's available on iOS. Do you have any plans to extend out to Android for us Android users?
At the moment, I would love to, but unfortunately, I coded the game Objective-C, which is Apple's domain. Mm-hmm. I used a small 2D game in Cocos 2D. Depending on how the game goes, I would love to port it to Android, but we'll have to see. Because I know as soon as you release a game on iOS, you get 10 messages. Is it on Android?
Yeah,
is it on Android? So I'm definitely aware, but we'll have to see.
Well, it's a really fun game and you should definitely give it a go. It's something that I've been really enjoying playing. If you're interested in finding out more about it, it's available right now on iOS. You can play it on iPad and on phone. You can play it vertically or you can play it horizontally, whatever you prefer.
Cool on you.
There's a variety of different controls as well. So you can have buttons on screen or you can have like sort of touchy, almost like virtual joystick sort of style controls as well. Deathhole.com is where you can find out more information. You can follow Tom at Ghost of Tomby on Twitter. Tom, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much. And congratulations again on being selected not once, but twice for the PAX Showcase.
Yeah.
How amazing is that? Thank you for having me. It's been great to talk to you.
That's been fantastic. And we'll definitely be catching up with you at PAX this year. That is about all the time we have for the show today. We just heard from deathhole.com, but if people do want to find out more about Deathhole, is that the best place for them to go?
It is. Or there's a trailer on YouTube as well that you can easily find by YouTubing Deathhole and my Twitter. That's about it.
Fantastic.
Well, come to PAX and say hello.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Everyone come down.
Let's say make hello a thing to everyone. Come and say hello.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Try and beat the first level.
Yeah, absolutely. The dev level. Well, thank you for joining us for another episode of Pixel Sift. Thank you very much for joining us tonight, Thomas, and telling us more about Deathhole.
Thank you.
This episode has been hosted by myself and Gianni. Big thanks to Gianni. This episode is produced by myself, Sarah Ireland, Fiona Bartholomeus, Mitch Lowe, and Gianni DiGiovanni as our executive producer. We wouldn't be able to make the 130 episodes of Pixel Sift if we didn't have the support of Murdoch University. Go and check them out and tell them we sent you. If you're keen to learn more about a great creative degree, head to murdoch.edu.au/arts. As always, I'll be sticking in links to the show on our website.
Website?
Yeah, that
which
one.
Which is pixelsift.com.au. As
like
well,
you
if
don't
you'd
know.
Like to... You know it. You know it by now. But hey, maybe from this.
Maybe you don't. Maybe your first time. And welcome,
in.
If that's the case.
Exactly. We love you. Thank you for coming here. Mm-hmm. Pixelsift.com.au, where you can find out all the show notes for every episode that we post live. You can find videos of some of our new series, like Sarah Survives or Farming Fridays, where you can watch those as well. You can join us on Discord. We'd love to have you there to talk about the episodes, what you've found out, how you got on board. That's Pixelsift.com. pixelsift.com.au/discord. You share your creative work as well. So if you're making something interesting, if you're making a game or you want to talk about games or maybe the Nintendo Direct, you can go to pixelsift.com.au/discord.
That's it. Our next episode will be on the 19th of September. If you join us this time next week on the 12th, it'll be Pixel Sift Plays, where we play some of the indie games that feature on our show. I think that's about all the time we have for this week.
That's it. Tell your friends.
Thank you for joining us. We'll catch you next time.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today at sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.